Now, I want to remind you, at the beginning of those two last lectures, today and Friday, what I said at the beginning, but which is, I'm sure, by now forgotten, namely that all that we could do for you here, obviously, spanning such a multitude of men and movements, is to give you a kind of framework, a skeleton upon which you can then, as it were, hang your clothes. Thus, if you have other points of view or disagreements or whatever with the analysis in the course, you will now at least have some kind of direction or framework with which to express, in which to express these disagreements, or, as one hopes, to make your own analysis. And because of that, I have now and then, of course, made things much too simple. And it was on the theory that the clearer the framework, the better. Because, as I said, this is a framework, and it cannot be anything more. Now, it is clear that all the kind of bewildering ideas and attitudes that have passed before your mind were, in a real way, the transition from the not-so-modern to the modern world. And I think it must be clear that the kind of ideas and issues that we've continued to discuss here are ideas and issues which will last. That from what we have discussed, as it were, very little has been lost. Whether the tradition of the Enlightenment or that of the religious revival or of Romanticism. These major ideas and attitudes from the beginning of the 19th century still have a direct effect, I think, upon our own perceptions of the world, because the underlying problems have not changed very much either. That is the problem of industrialism, of urbanism, of the more articulate masses, problems to which I shall come back, which are problems that start, in a way, with the French Revolution, or if you like, in the late 18th, early 19th century. These problems have not changed, while the problems of earlier periods, of course, have gone through change, largely because we now live in an industrialized, urban, more atomized society with more articulate masses. Now remember that we did start with another age altogether, with the Christian universe of the 17th century, and that we started with Pascal to give you at its best, I think, at its most important, some idea of this kind of Christian universe, which then had a direct relevance to the religious revivals of the 18th century. And from that, we turn back to the 17th century once again, to the Enlightenment, which had its roots, remember, in the Newtonian universe of the 17th century. So that we really started the course with Pascal and Newton, that is to say, with the continuing religious and Christian impetus on the one hand, and on the other hand, with the growth of modern science and the Enlightenment. The idea of reason, the building on Descartes' clear and distinct ideas, on the idea of logical system and experimentation, with the Enlightenment, we spent a lot of time then, as we did with its opposite, the religious revival. Remember that coming from the 17th century through the 18th century, the Enlightenment and the religious revivals determine very much of attitude towards life. But remember also that when we discussed the Enlightenment, we didn't just discuss Nathan, the wise, which you read, the good side, if you like, the toleration, the reason, the logic, but that there was here always a kind of dialectic, that the Enlightenment had what I called its underside as well, that the mania for classification did not stop with animals or nature, that the mania for classification took in human beings and slid over into aesthetics. The Enlightenment, remember, took Greek sources as authority, and that was to have lasting consequences, which went into the kind of stereotyping which we have discussed. So that in the Enlightenment itself, there is a highly subjective, irrational element when it comes to ideal types, to the ideal new man of the Enlightenment, namely his classification according to ideas of Greek beauty. From the religious revival and the Enlightenment, we went on then to several figures which tried to make a synthesis between the two. The first, obviously, was Rousseau. Rousseau, with whom you have reason, but you also go beyond reason to liquidate present society. You have a return to nature, but you also have ideas of the social contract and popular sovereignty. So that on the one hand, Rousseau takes many ideas of the Enlightenment, which must be clear to you, but he goes beyond. In the Education of Emile is an education to reason, but it uses nature and the irrational forces of human nature in order to train man to reason. Woman, of course, in Rousseau is not trained at all. It's man who is trained to reason. And then we went on to the major synthesis, the other major synthesis between Romanticism and the Enlightenment. We went on to Hegel. Now, the importance of Hegel is clear, even though it was most of your downfall. In your papers, your exams, in everything else. I was wondered why you all chose Hegel to write about, the thing most difficult to understand, you know, the thing easiest to get wrong. The thing about the Hegelian synthesis, which is so difficult for you, is that it is a real synthesis, much more than Rousseau. You can say for Rousseau, there is the irrational element in Emile. Emile is educated to nature. He isn't taught any reading. He lives in nature. It brings out the best, yes? And then he reads, and then he forms reason. But Hegel is out for interpenetration, which is on a quite different order of magnitude and understanding. So that you have the irrational in Hegel, obviously, the idea, which is really God's plan for the universe. I'll come back to that. The idea. You have the irrational in Hegel, the freedom, that man always strives for freedom. You have the irrational in Hegel, that history works in a determinate manner. But then you have the logic. History works according to logic and reason. But reason is interpenetrates with the irrational. And so you have what Hegel calls the cunning of reason, because reason is a matter of cunning. God is always rational. The plan for the world is always rational. But man does not know it because his self-consciousness may not have grown up enough to grasp it. So there is always an interpenetration between man and reason. And we are all the cunning of reason. It is all the cunning of reason, because in God's plan, everybody has its place. Not only the world historical individuals, but everybody has its place. No matter what you do, you are really working at your own self-consciousness, interacting with the dialectic of history. That, I think, is clear. But from this synthesis, we then veered, first of all, again to the predominance of the irrational forces with the new nationalism, which, after all, was not based on the Enlightenment, but based on the religious revivals, really, and properly speaking, evangelism and pietism, if you remember. And in the new nationalism at times, all that survives of the Enlightenment are the Greek symbolism, the Greek stereotypes, the Greek symbolism, the Greek national monuments, the Greek forms, like the capital here, but the Greek Greek form of symbolism and national monuments. But then we changed direction again and took up the heritage of the Enlightenment with liberalism and Marxism, which squarely stood in that kind of heritage. Always, of course, based on some presupposition which are beyond reason. But remember, even the philosophers didn't think you could explain everything by reason. They just thought reason was the best way to order the world. They were quite aware that there were irrational presuppositions. They were not fools. So what you have there is then, again, this kind of rhythm. Now, we had did relatively little in this kind of analysis with the geographical basis for these ideas. But it is clear from the 18th century, our focus shifted away from France to England and Germany, but above all to Central Europe. Perhaps a little too much, but there was a reason for it. Because what is called idealism in philosophy found its home there, the idea of totality, of abstraction. Now, it is true again that it is Rousseau in Switzerland, in France, really, in Geneva, French Switzerland, who first talks about the people, that abstraction. But in the end, ideas like the people and the nation and the Hegelian idea become German, Central European. And there comes to be a very big difference even between German and French nationalism. And the difference is rather simple. That Germany had no Cartesian tradition, but that the intellectual tradition in France was a Cartesian tradition, always the emphasis on clear and distinct ideas, the heritage of the Enlightenment, much more alive. And so that in the end you get a difference even in the nationalisms here. That is to say, in French nationalism, however racist, however, as we say, integral nationalism, however in France it was a totality, later with the so-called Action Française, with Morat, with all of this, reason plays a role. No matter how emotional French nationalism, always there is a certain emphasis on reason, on Cartesianism. Now, in Germany, that is not the case, because this particular 17th century tradition didn't exist. The Enlightenment was never very strong. And in any case, the wars of liberation obliterated much of the German Enlightenment, this great emotional upheaval of wars of national liberation, which France did not undergo. Even the wars of the French Revolution cannot be put in the same category as the wars of national liberation in this regard. Moreover, still more important, France is a Catholic nation. And Therefore, there was none of that tradition of evangelism and pietism, none of that tradition of seriousness, none of that tradition of facing God directly, none of that tradition of being able to integrate with the universe directly, whether it is the Christian universe or any other. In a Catholic nation, the lifestyle is different. Sins are graduated. Sins are graduated. The lifestyle is different. And therefore, in France, it being a Catholic nation, Catholicism itself has much more rationalism in it than evangelism and pietism, which were, in a sense, a reaction against a kind of fossilized Protestantism. So that Catholicism had, of course, a great rational tradition, which Protestantism no longer had, and certainly not evangelism and pietism. So the difference between France and Central Europe and even England here is quite considerably. And you can see it in the different kinds of nationalism. Yet in reality, therefore, matters are not quite, of course, that simple. We could have gone on in France with Napoleon III. We could have gone on with the particular kind of French culture of the Third Empire, but that culture of France, in a sense, looks much more to the end of the century, becomes much more important in the age of decadence and the end of the century, when France again becomes preeminent in Europe, than in the middle of the century, in a way, at the beginning and middle of the century, German idealism and the kind of evangelical tradition which we've studied in England seems to me to become important, more important relatively. But these are relative judgments. We always had to select, do not forget, we always had to select. We have neglected shamefully Catholicism. And here you would have talked about France. You would have talked about Lamennais. You would have talked about Catholic liberalism, a contradiction in terms, as it soon turned out. You would have talked about Catholic liberalism and all of these things I have not talked about at all because somehow you had to put the emphasis on something. Yet in reality, of course, all these systems and ideologies coexisted, came to terms with one another. This is clear, as all of these had to come to terms with nationalism. Sooner or later, whether it is Marxism or socialism or liberalism or anything, had to come to terms with nationalism. And that is Europe-wide. That is no distinction here between Germany, France, and England, except in England there was less of expressed nationalism, certainly until the First World War. It changes somewhat then. Until the First World War, there was less expressed perhaps in England because England had the empire. And to get English nationalism, you don't look to England. You look to India. You look to the empire, and you don't look to England. So it's totally wrong to say England had no nationalism. England did have nationalism. But it was in the empire, while the rest of the European nationalism worked above all at home. This would even, I think, be true for France to a large degree. Now I think we will muddy the waters a little less if we think of all that we have treated. Not so much as ideology, which is a word which first appears in Napoleon. It was a bad word. Napoleon used it first for the intellectuals of the French Academy who were not practical. He called them ideologues, as some people who were not practical, who were sort of dreamers in the French Academy, with whom Napoleon I couldn't do a great deal. That's how the word got going, the word ideologue. And, of course, eventually it became transmuted into what we might call, and I'll come back to that on Friday, the history of ideas. But we haven't been doing this at all, the history of ideas, because if we did a history of ideas, then we would have had to do the great ideas of the times, of which I have omitted a great many. Lamennais, Gobineau, I have omitted, the list is vast, that I have omitted. But I think it makes it easier if you think of what we have done as producing attitudes towards life. And that is why I have always returned to the, what you might call, perception of things, the myths people live by, and how the myths reify a life. And here, therefore, we have gone to a world which is not the world of great ideas, but rather the world of symbols, the world of myths. And when we say myths, it means that grasping for continuities, this attempt to integrate yourself into some kind of immutability, which are myths, whether it's the history of your ancestors, which is totally mythical, usually. Dreadful people, most of your ancestors. The history of your ancestors, or whether it is nature, or whether it is Christianity, I don't care what. It is always these myths, yes, with which people integrate themselves, which makes it possible to cope. But as I said in my original lecture, the myths are expressed by symbols. People don't think in abstraction. You are not the only one who find it difficult to think in abstractions. You're not particular in that. Nobody really can think very well in abstraction unless he's had a certain training almost from his youth, a certain European training. But certainly Americans who are trained in the tradition of the Enlightenment find it very, very difficult to think in abstraction. Don't say because I teach Hegel here and I teach it in Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem, it's very easy to teach and almost immediately grasped by my students there because they come from European or Latin American or training, which is training in abstraction. And in America, it's very difficult to teach because Americans have no training in abstractions at all. I think if I taught Hegel in Italy or anywhere, it would be much the same and just as easy. So, but most people have no training in abstraction, and so they have to be dependent on symbols. They have to be dependent on symbols, and always have been. And therefore, to a certain extent, we have been dealing with the symbols which express attitude towards life. The symbols which express attitude towards life, whether these symbols were the national stereotypes that we dealt with, the manners and morals and respectabilities, or political symbols of one sort or another. It is clear that we've always dealt with this kind of symbols. So then I think it will help you to think of matters as the big systems of thought, like Hegel and Rousseau and Nathan the Wise, by and large, the things you have read. They did determine attitudes of life, but not so directly as indirectly, through the myths and symbols, which in a way they directed and they helped form and they helped bring together in a kind of synthesis. Now, of course, Rousseau's government of Poland is full of myths and symbols. That is clear. And even Hegel has a lot on symbols which you didn't read. Even Hegel was very much concerned with finding the right kind of symbols so that people's self-consciousness could grow. So it's a general kind of concern. Now, if myth and symbol go together, there is, however, something else that comes in, another element, a third element with myth and symbol, And that you might call is the longing for utopia, the longing for a better world. For while on the one hand you have a longing for continuities, there is no doubt that on the other hand you have a general longing for utopia, for a better world. And it is Ernst Bloch who said after the First World War in the criticism of Marxism that you cannot have revolution without utopia. That one of the difficulties with Marxism that we've studied so long is that it had lost utopia. And that's, of course, quite true. With the loss of Hegelianism and with the predominance of science, Marxism did leave this kind, utopia. And people don't make revolutions unless they have before them some kind of utopia. Now, these utopias always that you have studied always have certain things in common which may have struck you or should have struck you, perhaps. One, they are classless utopias. That's true for everything, even the liberals. The liberals just thought everybody should have property, everybody should have a yeoman society. But there would be no class, of course. Marxism, no classless society. And that goes, of course, with the sense of community. Well, the sense of community, a community of affinity. Not a forced community. That's what nationalism is about. But even liberalism, with its ideas of consensus, strives to make a community of affinity. So we can say what these utopias have in common is the classless society, the community of affinity, if you like, a kind of equality. Nationalism, again, strives for that. All ideas we have strives for that, a kind of equality. And finally, of course, harmony, the absence of conflict, harmony. Harmony, equality, community, classless society, all these things are part of the kind of utopia that you have in what is, after all, an industrializing, fragmented, class-ridden world. Now, of course, these utopias also differed. Some of them openly were industrial utopia. How openly you can dispute in some of them. Liberalism thought that this utopia could only come about in industrial society. That's clear. So even it had this kind of idea, the worker must have his piece of land, the worker must have property. But they also had sharing, profit sharing, so that you can say it's an industrial vision. With Marx, yes, it's an industrial vision, but oddly enough, it's expressed in pre-industrial terms. Hunting in the morning and fishing in the afternoon is hardly what you would call an industrial vision. So, though it is again expressed in this kind of matter. So it's not that clear. It's not that clear. Perhaps in industrial society, all utopia has to be expressed in pre-industrial forms in order to connect with the continuities people want, in order to the out people want, in order that out people want. Eventually, nobody takes vacations in cities. You take vacations in the country. So it's the out people want. It's this kind of thing. So even Marx expresses his idea in rural terms. But those who rejected industrialism, and it's clear who did that after all, nationalism, romanticism, they didn't reject it that clearly. Nationalism didn't reject capitalism, but only finance capitalism, only big banks and stock exchanges and things of that nature. But they too didn't reject modernity. Nationalism had perhaps even greater than socialism, a love of technology. And eventually you get that division between technology and science. which is so obvious, in National Socialism, in all fascism. Hitler and Mussolini were the first politicians to use the airplane, for example. Speedy cars, airplanes, all of this goes together with this nationalism. You cannot say that nationalism is a rejection of modernity. You have to ask what sort of modernity. And it is certainly not a rejection of technology, certainly not of military technology, but not even of any other technology, not even of any other technology. The heightened nationalism, fascism, was the first European movement which, as it were, used technology and integrated it into its very fabric. So that's not true. You must distinguish between these matters, just as their various forms of capitalism. So that it's not so simple that these utopias accepted and rejected. In a sense, then, it is much more complicated. But you can put it another way. Did they accept or reject the rush of time? And again, that is more complicated. Obviously, every utopia wants continuities, no matter what. But it is quite clear that liberalism and Marxism, with their idea of progress, accepted more, if you like, of the change of time than, let us say, nationalism and romanticism accepted of this change of time. But I must remind you again that here, of course, the change of time impinged upon all perception. Remember, that starts even at the beginning of what we said, when Goethe wrote in 1799 that people now come into the theater with a newspaper in their pockets, and Goethe thought that was the end of art, and it was. So what you have, therefore, at least much of written art, is clear, this idea. And that, of course, is accentuated with the railway travel, with the first railway, so that you get a kind of progress here. In the 18th century, the macadamization of roads brought nature near. Without it, you could not have any romanticism, because to feel nature romantically, you had to go to it. And that means you had to have decent roads and a decent police force. Both come in the 18th century. That makes things accessible. And the railroads come in the 1830s. And they, as I said before, make this problem of the speed of time a still greater and more immediate problem. As greater and immediate problem. As the British medical journal, The Lancet, wrote in 1862, railway travel was something for medicine to write about. The Lancet: the speed and difference of perception in railway travel necessarily tire the eye and the brain. The constant change in distance of objects mean a constant straining of eye and brain, of the retina and of the brain. That means nervousness of the brain and disease of the eye. So that there was a great sense that of the nervousness of the age, which went in actually to the nervousness of railway travel, that further, as it were, loosens and makes nervous these nervous times. So that the nervous times became an issue, again brilliantly exploited by Adolf Hitler, who made it a motto of his book Mein Kampf, that the nervous 19th century has come to an end. And that was a great attraction again, because of the nervousness of this railway travel. Or as Victor Hugo wrote in 1837, right at the beginning of the of the railway age. He said, if you travel by rail, the flowers are no longer flowers, but only dots of color, red and white dots. Everything is dots. The wheat fields are long extensions. Everything becomes a crazy. People are shadows. And says Victor Hugo, where is still reality to be found? Railway travel meant a lack of reality. A lack of reality, and it symbolized for people this kind of speed of time that I have talked about, the nervous diseases of a nervous century. The two main causes for nervousness in 19th century are masturbation and railway travel. And both were the main concerns of medical journals and the main concern of the doctor, because the doctor becomes the guardian now of manners and morals. And therefore, he is concerned with both. I have told you that before. And thus the continuity. Thus, if you like, finally, in this, the constant urge towards self-definition. The constant urge towards self-definition. Self-definition of the bourgeoisie through respectability. The self-definition, the constant urge which you have studied. Now, if the speed of time is basic, there is a second basic factor to the disorientation of the age, and that is what I would call the transmutation of Christianity. Now, notice, I don't say the war between church and state, because what happened in the process of secularization was not a conflict, was not really a war. Pietism, evangelism, much of romanticism, nationalism, contained a lot of Christianity, its moral system, its liturgical rhythm. Nobody realized when Mussolini made that dialogue of the balcony of the Palazzo Venezia in Rome with the people that he was really adopting the responsas of Christian liturgy. The liturgy of nationalism is the liturgy of Christianity. It's the only liturgy people knew. And so it was adopted. So you have the liturgy, but you don't only have the liturgy. You have the whole moral idea of a moral universe of Christianity, with its emphasis on purity, with its emphasis on sexual restraint, with the sin of Sodom. With all of these, you have really a Christianity remaining on that level. Remember that Christianity was still a major issue at mid-century. To the young Hegelians, the dominant issue, Christianity against the state, just as for the French philosophers, it was Christianity against the Enlightenment. But that they fought Christianity, that they thought it was a major issue, didn't mean that they didn't, almost certainly without knowing it, adopt both its moral universe and, if you like, its liturgical rhythms. They adopted them, partly because that was the only moral universe that had tradition and the liturgical rhythm, because that was all the liturgy people knew. So that eventually, when you get respectability, for example, for reasons of self-definition of the middle class, it is based, as you have learned, on evangelism and pietism, on a kind of revival of the Christian moral universe against aristocratic frivolity, against what was thought the atheism of the Jacobins. So that the process of secularization is a process of fusion of what Hegel would call the cunning of reason. The cunning of reason. It is a process of the dialectic that must be clear. For example, as E.P. Thompson has shown, the lucid imagery and fervor of English Methodism led eventually to political rebellion, to the building of an English workers' movement. That what really led to the building of the English workers' movement was Methodism, not Marxism. And that was, of course, not Methodism's intent at all. It's a good example of, if you like, the kind of cunning of reason that you have involved here. I think a very good example of it. So that you must remember that the changing perceptions, the old slides over into the new. And here again, I think Hegelian dialectic is true. I think in a sense this is actually how things do work. It slides over. It slides over. It is not a confrontation. Atheists don't reject Christianity. They reject it, but they also accept its moral universe. They accept its liturgical rhythm, which is our political culture. Our political culture is based on these Christian rhythms and to a great extent on Christian symbolism, of course on classical beauty, but on Christian actions and symbolisms, but above all, the moral universe of respectability, of manners and morals. That again must be quite clear. Even Marxism accepted that, as I tried to make clear to you last time. Even Marx, in his idealizing of marriage, in his idealizing of the marriage bond, in his sort of rejection of all sexual deviance or unconventional behavior, accepted this kind of moral universe. And remember, it wasn't always so. If these people were back in the 17th century, in the 17th century, the 17th century. What is the 17th century for us today? It is sexual titillation. You read about it in historical novels. You see about it on television. And you see a life that seems to us today frivolous, licentious. But you can show it because it's a life among the nobility, the upper classes, and it is a kind of historical pornography. That's what the 17th century has become to our age. So you have a change. It was not pornography to the 17th century, needless to say, yes? And if you contrast the life of Martin Luther with the life of the middle classes, there could not be a greater contrast between Luther, the heavy drinker, the sleeper arounder, all of these things, for which I shall get no end of radio mail, because, again, that went through the fire of evangelism. Evangelism, and you get a new Luther, the respectable Luther. That's not the historical Luther. So, again, I make it clear to you that you have a revival here with this Christian moral universe. Now, I make it clear to you because the process of secularization, this process of secularization is a process which is not a confrontation. Nothing really is, you know, very little. But it is a process of co-optation. It is a process of co-optation. It is a process of ordering yourself into a tradition and combining the old with the new. And yet, having said all this, there are new factors. Two new factors. The middle classes, looking for self-definition, finding it in nationalism, in respectability, in liberalism, against the aristocracy and against the working classes. And the other new factor is, of course, the factor of the masses. Gobineau at mid-century in France and Calvinus in Germany had nightmares. And the nightmare was that the future of Europe is Caesars and masses confronting each other. They thought, of course, of Napoleon III, but they thought of Caesars and masses confronting each other. So the problem of the mass is a new problem, if you like, a new and unprecedented problem. It adds to the frighteningness which comes then with the railway age, with the nervous 19th century. There is added the masses which become ever more articulate. The first mass movements are in the 19th century. The first mass demonstrations are in the 19th century, in the 1830s, the decade in which socialism starts. That is the decade of the first mass movement. So that there is something new added, the organized masses, not just the Jacquerie, an unorganized uprising, but now it's the organized masses, not the unorganized masses, the organized masses. And that is, of course, really frightening. And against that, the middle class builds its elite with Tom Brown and others whom you have studied. What I want to do in the last lecture on Friday, I want to see how all this bears on culture, because we have said relatively little about the changing locus of culture, yes? From coffee house to I don't know what.